got a troubled mind. Wash it out and hang it up on a clothing line, and the sun will shine.
Hey everybody, welcome to the Science Facts and Fallacies podcast brought to you by the Genetic Literacy Project. I'm your host, Cameron English.
And I'm your co-host, Kevin Folta, a professor who cares about science communication.
This is the weekly show where we discuss the biggest stories from the Genetic Literacy Project to keep you informed about groundbreaking developments from the worlds of science and medicine, and of course, to help you separate facts from fallacies as you read the headlines. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the show. Cameron and Kevin here as always. What's going on, Kevin?
Oh, nothing. I rented a trencher and going to tool rental places is always a happy way to start a week, and excited about that.
Right on. Right on. I listened to our last episode and I realized my Christopher Walken accent sounds more like Dracula. So I got to put in a little bit of work.
Yeah, I know. Mine sounded more like Jackie Mason.
Yeah. I was going to say kind of godfathery, but yeah, that works too.
Yeah. So, but neither of us are thespians.
You know, this is true. We just speak from our hearts and hopefully people enjoy it, or they call us shills. So one way or the other, we are touching people's lives.
Yeah. All good. And, you know, and when people do call us shills, we should note that all of the information about Genetic Literacy Project and its funding, as well as all of our personal whatever funding or involvement with GLP, all that's public information. So if anybody ever has questions, give us a call, give us an email, and, you know, we'll be happy to field those things. Because as this podcast gains in popularity, you start to read stuff around, you know, like, obviously they're just funded by the ag companies, you know. So you start seeing that kind of thing again. And you know, it's an invitation to those listening to, you know, dial us up and, you know, be glad to talk to you about what that's all about.
Yeah, absolutely. And you can just look at the content we publish. You know, a fair amount of it is not very industry friendly because we just follow the science where it goes. And so if someone does something or says something that we know is wrong, then we say, hey, that's wrong. And that's always the policy. So yeah, what Kevin said, just check out the website, check out the annual reports we put out, that it's all there. We're not hiding anything. But with that out of the way, let's jump into the stories. So first up, anti-GMO groups in Latin America are waging a PR war to try to get gene-edited crops out of the region. So what exactly are they doing, and how likely are they to succeed? Next up, can GMOs change your DNA? The answer, of course, is no, but this keeps floating around the internet. So we're going to do a bit of a deep dive into this issue and a handful of other biotech myths that just won't go away, apparently. And then finally, GM crops actually do increase food production. Again, you might have read something different online, but we're going to actually get into the studies on this question and give you guys the hard facts on this. But first up, Kevin, what's going on in Latin America?
Well, in Latin America, I mean, I should mention, this is the first episode we've done that's all crop biotechnology.
Yes, so, GMO week.
Yeah, so there you go. So it's right in my wheelhouse. So let's talk about Latin America. And an article that was written by Luis Ventura, he basically talks about the fact that the anti-biotech groups are alive and well in Latin America, and there kind of is a battle for its soul at this point, because the EU has decided that gene editing is off the table. Yet the countries of South America, many of them are very well invested in biotechnology and continue or plan to continue using it. Other ones have different feelings, and there are opportunities in those countries to create problems as activists. So the anti-biotech voices are weighing kind of heavily in some of these. And they point to Chile as one of them, where here's a place where Chile is a huge country in agriculture, fantastic for agriculture, and that they're actually amplifying GM seeds there. They actually grow them, make the seeds, but the farmers there can't use them. So it's a question of, you know, here they are growing seeds for Brazil and for Argentina, but none of them allowed in Chile. And so it's really put us their farmers at a disadvantage. So this is the basic idea. There's activists who are pushing the idea of eliminating GE crops, or at least gene-edited crops, from getting a toehold in South America.
And just to follow up on that example from Chile, they actually import the grain from those seeds back as human food and as animal feed. So the policy makes no sense. And I think he calls it schizophrenic, really, in the article. And it is a fascinating look at what happens when you have these two warring factions. But this is a quote from the article. He says, according to Spanish biochemist J.M. Mollet or Mollet, not sure how to pronounce
Mollet,
it.
Yeah,
Mollet. Mollet, okay. The campaign against GMOs is driven by ignorance, economic interests, and a desire for notoriety on the part of activist groups. Greenpeace, for example, initiate anti-biotech campaigns in countries where they're most likely to succeed best on careful, quote, market criteria. That strikes me as so incredibly cynical. And I think he goes on to say later in the article that Greenpeace is basically inactive on the biotech issue in America, even though we're still the world leader in GMO crop production and in research. So it just strikes me as, you know, we're going where we can have the biggest impact, no matter what the science tells us.
Well, that's exactly it. They're going to South America because they have to stop the spread of this technology. And they know they've lost it here, that farmers use it and it's very profitable for farmers. It's expanding. Opportunities are growing. But Latin America is special because you can still go there and make an argument that these big American companies are just there to destroy the native heritage varieties, or to take over what indigenous people have created. And there's a very compelling argument there for people in Latin America because, you know, they do have their favorite varieties and their agricultural land and their traditional varieties. And so they can, Greenpeace and others can play to that. And that's terribly effective.
You know, I think there's a lesson there. As I said, you know, it's very cynical, but I think if we can maintain our ethics, I think we can learn from how they ingratiate themselves into the political and the cultural discussions, and really how they sell what they do. And that's why I found this whole discussion so fascinating, because I came from a sales background and I noticed people like you were saying the same things that I was being taught as a young salesperson in terms of how you connect with people and how you demonstrate the value of what your product is. And in this case, it's science literacy and, you know, what science can do for the world. What's your exact tagline? Helping people on the planet, you know?
Technologies that helping people on the planet.
Yeah, absolutely. But I think that beautifully sums up what it's about. So all that to say, I think we're getting a lot better at this on the science side, if you will. But I think for decades, that was really lacking and no one understood the sort of PR juggernaut they were up against.
Well, and last week we talked about disinformation and talked about an article by Dr. Cami Ryan. And she really talks about the how disinformation is so critical and so important for the activists to get in front of people, because it confirms their bias, right? The U.S. not necessarily always being viewed as positive. It's just the big companies from somewhere else coming to infringe on our native resources. And that's a very compelling piece of misinformation or disinformation. It suggests that it gets people automatically on their side around a social and national interest. And so it's very penetrant disinformation. See, I almost used the two wrong interchangeably. it is bad information. And a big part of what Dr. Ryan calls the attention economy. It's the activists being able to manage the perception by keeping people interested in their messages.
Well, just to wrap us up on a happy note on this, Luis ends the article with the observation that although these groups have been very influential, they're sort of one-trick ponies, because this is, and Kevin, you know this better than anyone, I think, but back in the late 90s, the playbook they're using now, it's the same playbook they're using against gene editing. And so he ends the article with the observation that these technologies are different and you can introduce benefits that target consumers directly. And so people see, oh, wow, you know, this apple tastes better, or it lasts longer, or it's more nutritious, or, you know, it deals with climate change issues. It deals with things that are in front of people's faces every day. And so a lot of these countries are starting to introduce regulations that are more amenable to gene editing. And so maybe, I don't want to predict the future, but it seems like we're sort of seeing a shift in the dynamic. Like, people just aren't buying the same fear, uncertainty, and doubt kind of a narrative that they would, say, 15 or 20 years ago.
Oh, exactly. And I think a big part of it is that, you know, your EU has swung that way. And they did capitulate to fearful messages. And the funny part is that I think there's a lot of fatigue around the negative information around food, that people do see increased abundance, more food security in the developing world, rats that don't really turn out to be, you know, tube socks stuffed with ping pong balls, like was published 8 years ago now and never reproduced. So people see all of that they're seeing it more skeptically, which I think is a really good thing.
Yeah, I've heard it described as green fatigue. I don't know if that's a technical term. It may have been just from a single article that I read. But yeah, you know, you keep telling people the world's going to end and they're going to run out of food and there's too many people, so on and so forth. And then at some point they just go, well, you're just crying wolf now. I'm over this. And that's encouraging in this case. So, you know, let's put that aside, though. I think that's an encouraging news overall. So I want to get into these myths, Kevin. I remember when I first took an interest in this issue, like 10 years ago, I remember reading these online, specifically the GMOs changing your DNA. So introduce us to this.
So this is an article that came out in Ag Daily, and it was just basically a primer for debunking the common misconceptions. And maybe you and I can go through these one by one, or maybe we could, you know, talk about them. But the basic idea is that there's a number of claims that are continually made over and over again, and none of them are true, or at least very nuanced if they are. And this one talks about a whole series. The first myth being, one that you just mentioned, is that GE crops change your DNA and then lead to things like cancer and all that stuff. But DNA that you consume is broken down like DNA that you would consume from any organism. If you eat GE corn, that DNA is broken down like DNA out of other corn or out of broccoli or out of the trillions of bacteria you swallow every single day. All that stuff gets broken down by digestive enzymes into its component parts and assembled back into what you are. And so there is absolutely no evidence that there is anything in a GE crop that can change your DNA. So that's one of the myths that we can debunk.
Right, right. And in quite a few cases, you're eating the end product that has no DNA in it anyway.
That's right. That's right.
So just keep that in mind, you know, especially with a lot of processed products. But moving on, the other one that I love talking about is this idea that GMOs are entirely natural. And I don't mean that as a sleight of hand. I mean the way that organisms can transfer DNA back and forth happens in nature. I mean, that's where the idea came from. So tell us more about this.
Well, the process that's used in the laboratory is just scientists in the lab harnessing something that occurs in nature and exploiting it for their own ends. Instead of natural genes and natural processes moving pieces of nature around, we can decide what piece of the payload we want those bacteria, in this case, to deliver to a plant cell. And if you look at things like the sweet potato has a genetically engineered insert into it that humans didn't put there. It has the hardware that the bacteria that we use, Agrobacterium. So let me just rephrase this. In the laboratory, we use a thing called Agrobacterium tumefaciens to transfer a piece of DNA to the plant cell. The bacteria does the work. But it turns out there's examples in food where bacteria has done this. And it's added DNA to things like sweet potatoes. And it doesn't matter at all. So it's the argument that somehow this idea of by modifying a genome by adding something is human driven and dangerous, but bacteria have been doing it for a very long time, and we seem to like it, and it's just fine.
And if you guys want to choke on some irony today, the butterfly on the non-GMO project label that you see everywhere in the grocery store, that butterfly is a GMO. Because if you go back and look at its evolutionary history, at some point it swapped DNA, I believe, with some kind of a virus or some kind of a fungus. And so the very animal they use to represent, you know, pure, natural, non-GMO food is genetically engineered by nature.
Yeah. Actually, well, if you look at genomes, they're loaded with viral bits. So many viruses are just, they leave their remains within our cells. Corn is something like 75% viral DNA. I mean, it's ridiculous. So, you know, a lot of good examples of genetic engineering in naturally occurring or naturally bred or land races of different crops.
Let's talk a little bit about this idea of a corporate takeover of the global food supply. I think this is another one that never seems to go away. What's your impression of that as an agricultural scientist?
Yeah, it kind of drives me nuts because, you know, all that these companies are doing is generating products that farmers want to buy. And they don't sell to you and me, you know, the big companies. They sell to farmers. And they come up with new technologies that cause plants to grow better and more efficiently and or with fewer inputs and give good yields. And if they achieve that, farmers buy it. It's not that they're taking over the world by forcing people to buy things. Try forcing a farmer to do anything. You know, they do what, you know, these are fiercely independent businessmen and women who do what they want to do, what they feel that best benefits their operation. Sometimes not the best move, but so they do what they want to do because that's the way they do it. And no seed company is going to twist their arm any other way.
So this idea of corporate takeover, I think it's a great example of gaslighting, I think, because if you look at who pushes these really intense and really strict regulations for the approval process for biotech crops, in many cases, it's these activist groups or it's regulators and politicians who are sympathetic to them ideologically. So on one hand, they make it incredibly expensive and time consuming to get one of these seeds approved. And then they turn around and they say, look, the only ones that can afford it are the big wealthy companies that we hate. This is just unacceptable. It's like, well, yeah, we'll stop playing, you know, burning the candle from both ends or whatever terrible analogy you want to use. You know what I mean?
Oh, sure. You know, let academic scientists start playing in the sandbox. You know, I know lots of people who would be very happy to have their corn variety or something they've bred distributed and available, you know, for farmers to grow. But getting something deregulated out of the public sector is probably pretty close to impossible. And the only times it's ever happened, it's never ended well for the product. But if you look at those regulations, they're made to benefit the companies. And so the activists, like you say, want a high bar. Now the only people who can get over the bar are the people they don't like. So it takes away competition from the market, especially in the age of consolidation.
Yeah. I economically, it seems like just a classic case of maybe protectionism, you know, and it's really frustrating. And going back, just to go back to Luis's story for a second, but he talks about this too, about how you have public sector researchers in these Latin American countries working for universities, working for nonprofits. And when the government clamps down on this research, sure, you know, Bayer has to leave or, you know, Syngenta has to leave or whatever. But then these local people who you know, they work for the public, their labs get shut down and their funding gets cut off. And so just to repeat myself, you're reinforcing the very system you say is not workable. It drives me nuts, frankly.
Yeah. It's one of the things that's always been, always kind of stuck in me too, but there's other stuff that they mention in this Ag Daily article that is really important. And, some of the ideas like non-GMO means that the food has not been genetically modified. And it's kind of touched on this already, that there's lots of examples of ways to change DNA in plants. And it's not necessarily adding a gene. That's what they call transgenic. For 50 years now, we've been hitting plants with radiation and chemistry to create damage that's favorable. That every once in a while you get, it's called mutation breeding, where you subject plants to radiation or chemistry that damages DNA where 50% of the seeds are just dead. They're so damaged. But once in a while, you get a seed that does very well or has a trait that is you really want. And now you can breed that back into a population. That's a genetic modification. It changes DNA, but it's not adding this big chunk of hardware that people equate with genetic engineering. It's not nearly as precise, probably a lot more risky, but perfectly allowable. You can grow it on your organic farm and nobody wants a label. It's a really interesting situation.
I think a few years ago, there was some organic trade group that tried to figure out how many different breeding techniques were used to produce the organic crops that are in production today. And I think they got to, there was like five or six different techniques, like laboratory techniques. They're not transgenesis, but there's all sorts of ways to introduce mutations into a plant's genome. And to recall our story from last week about that detecting gene edits, if you were to apply those standards, and Kevin, correct me if I'm wrong here, but if you were to apply the test that they used, that Greenpeace used in that study, you could call basically anything gene edited or whatever you want, because you're just identifying mutations in the DNA of the plant. So it's all silly and confused as a category, I guess.
And that's what it is. It really gets to the point where we try to have an honest conversation and a technical conversation, and you talk about the way that genes are different and genes connected to traits, that different traits all are based on differences in DNA. And we like those. You know, that's like a really good thing. So this is where a lot of those myths happen.
Okay, well, let's move on to our final story. And I think it's pretty tightly connected to what we've been talking about with these different myths. And I think maybe this is like the biggest one, like the biggest boogeyman that I've heard for years. And that's this idea that GM crops don't increase crop yields. So tell us about this story.
Yeah, this is something that came from Neurologica, written by Steven Novella, who's one of my heroes. And Dr. Novella brings back the concept of the argument that, well, there just is no increase in yield. And this was something that was pitched by folks like Danny Hakim at the New York Times, endlessly by folks like Vandana Shiva. You see it even in things like the National Academies of Sciences report was not real strong in saying that there's an increase in yields. But the reason for that is not really discussed, and the validity of that claim is not discussed. First, there has never been a trait installed to increase yield. You know, that was specifically put in to increase yield. And they're out there. There's some traits that you can put in that would cause massive increases in fruit size or number of ears per corn cob or whatever. Those exist, but that has not been done. So right off the bat, the reason that GE crops exist is to, what if you can get the same yield, but you can do it by applying less insecticide, save money, save fuel, save labor. That is the value for the farmer. The glyphosate tolerant crops, you can spend less time killing weeds. You know, just one spray with glyphosate, maybe two, can help limit weed competition. So you see increases in yield as a byproduct of better quality crops that have traits that allow them to be happy and healthy. But no trait has ever been installed in any of the current crops that implicitly increases yield.
He uses the analogy. He says this criticism of biotechnology, it's like criticizing airbags because they don't increase fuel efficiency. I think that's pretty good, right? Because the direct purpose, as you said, is, you know, this very specific issue, like better weed control. Now, as a side effect, you get more yields. And so, again, the critique is just very confused from the very beginning.
Right. And that's a very good analogy. The good part about this that people fail to realize is that you do see increases in these crops because they have less insect or weed competition from very effective methods to decrease the insect populations and competition from weeds. So you do actually see yields when you look across all of the different papers that are involved. And he was really keying off of one meta-analysis that started, you know, it's covered a substantial number of articles that showed very clearly that there was an increase in yield. The other side that was important was the percentage of mycotoxins. So these are the really toxic compounds that we find inside corn and other damaged crops that in the U.S. are not such a big deal because we screen for them and we have ways to limit them. But in the developing world is a huge problem, and we've talked about that before. Here, GE crops stand to reduce mycotoxin loads because they have less insect damage, less places for fungus to enter the plant. So that's a real big score.
Yeah, and to fill in the data that you were talking about, so this was a real famous analysis from 2016 or 17, I want to say, but it was an analysis of 6,000 studies from 21 years, over the course of 21 years, showing that corn increased yields up to 25%, and then, dramatically decreased the mycotoxin contaminants. And like I said, or like you said, we talked about that with the SDHI fungicides that Europe's trying to ban right now. So, I mean, this is a significant deal. And then to go back to your point about, farmers not being duped by big companies, he makes that point here, and he says, farmers are not stupid, nor are they being manipulated. They buy GM seeds because it's to their advantage to do so. And here's my own editorializing. I just think it's so condescending to talk down to an entire population of people whom you've probably never interacted with if you live in the suburbs or if you live in a big city, but yet you jump on Google and you find some articles that validate your assumptions and say, let me tell you what's good about farming. I just find that very, aside from the facts, I find that whole mindset just very arrogant and irritating.
Yeah, I agree. But that's what this is all about, right? When you don't have the facts on your side, you have to find ways to confirm the biases of others who might share your same concerns. And that's what the whole anti-GMO movement has been about now for as long as there's been hints of genetically engineered crops. But that's where we're at. The bottom line is, as you mentioned, farmers won't use it if it doesn't make them money. And higher yields, lower input costs, all of those things are what go into that calculus.
Yeah. And, you know, just to wrap up, I forget who said it. It was someone on Twitter who we both know, but I forget her name, so I don't want to screw it up. But she was arguing with somebody on Twitter, and she said, you know, by the way, I just want to point out that we pay Monsanto for their products because they work. They don't pay us to promote their products. So
that's right.
You have it exactly backwards in your theory of this grand conspiracy, you know? And I think that really drives home the point.
Yeah. It's Farm Babe Michelle Miller. She, that's what she says all the time. Like, you know, we pay them. You know, we buy their products. So, and if it's not good, they switch over to Syngenta or BASF. You know, all these different companies, I shouldn't say all these, there's what, three now. But there are plenty of other companies that are playing in this space more and more. Farmers are having increased choice rather than narrower choices, even though there are fewer companies. But it's because the products work. And that's the bottom line.
Yes, yes. And I keep thinking of things to say, but we have a frequently asked questions article on the GLP website about this question of monopoly and competition in the seed industry. And it's very thoroughly researched and there's lots of resources in there. So go check that out. But let's call it a day, Kevin. What's going on over at your other podcast, Talking Biotech?
Well, I had such a nice time reading Cami Ryan's article last week with you that I invited her on as a guest, and we had a wonderful conversation about communication in science and the idea of ideas of disinformation and why it's important for scientists to be involved in the conversation, scientists and science enthusiasts, because of the power of disinformation and how it penetrates. And it's a really good episode. She's really a great interview, and I think you'll enjoy it.
Very good. Check it out as always. And that's going to do it for us. We are on Twitter at CamJEnglish, at Kevin Folta, geneticliteracyproject.org. And we'll see you next time.